The topic for tonight is holding the past and future. I thought I would talk about this at this point because lately we're all living with severe restrictions in order to fight this pandemic. And many people find that they're obsessed with the future or pining for aspects of the past. So I want to talk tonight about what the Dharma and our practice offer for us to make peace with this peculiar point in time. When teachers lead meditation, they often discourage thoughts about the past or the future. After years of meditating this way, we can come to feel that we should always stay in the present. And that might be a good idea, but we have to plan for the future. And as for the past events, untangling our memories and reactions to them can release us from states of mind that cause us dukkha, or inner suffering. So how do we hold the past and future in a way that supports our practice? And how can our practice help us deal with times other than this very moment? When I picked the title for this talk, I knew what it meant to hold an experience because I had encountered that expression often enough to catch the meaning by how it was usually used. But if I've ever read or heard an actual definition, I've forgotten it. So here's my definition. It's how we relate to an event or our inner response to it. It's accepting and knowing phenomena in a fairly intimate way, allowing them to just be what they are as we pay close attention to how they function and affect us emotionally. This definition implies that the past is not entirely static, as it's commonly thought, and that the future is so vague that metaphorically we need to gather it up and hold on to it. These days, with all of the disruption of the COVID-19 pandemic, people seem to spend most time grappling with the future. There's a lot of fear and hope. In general, our relationship with the future is predominantly governed by desire and aversion. In some ways, this makes it easier for me to talk about than the past, which can be pretty complicated. Our relationship with it is very complicated. So while your minds are fresh from meditating, I'm going to tackle the past first. It's good to hold in the mind that although memory is about events that occurred in the past, thinking about them occurs in the present. The salient aspect of remembering the past is our current emotional reaction to it. This usually contains some element of dukkha, or suffering, on a spectrum that goes from PTSD type of misery to a slight frisson of nostalgia. Mindfulness lets us recognize the distinction between what happened back then and the memory that's in our awareness right now. We may also be mindful enough to note that memories of an event are not completely accurate because of the way they're stored in the brain. Memories can be expected to degrade over time. We may continue to remember certain events frequently, but each time we do so, the memories change. So when memories arise, we can practice with them in a way that will benefit us. Mindfulness practice is all about investigating our inner experience in response to mental formations like memories. We're in the best position to do this when there's some mental space between this replay of the past and the emotions that currently accompany it. In other words, mindfulness lets us stay aware that this memory we're having is not an actual worldly event, but a fabrication of the mind. Bearing this in mind gives us the space to do the most important thing we can do with our practice: dispassionately examine our emotional reaction and identify how and why there's suffering mixed in with it. Our practice is a complex process of delving always deeper into the mind. Memories cause and continue to support long-standing states of mind, like attitudes, assumptions, beliefs, and values. They're a bit like plaque sticking to the walls of the arteries, potentially messing up a lot of the body's processes. When we're mindful enough to investigate how memories affect us emotionally, we get close to seeing how these current emotions influence pre-existing states of mind, whether they add to the problem or help the situation. Just seeing this dynamic is usually enough to alter these old mind states. And that potentially frees us from the dukkha they carry. it breaks up that stuff that's sticking to the pathways of the mind and clogging them up. Okay, here's an example. It's not meant to be realistic or have anything to do with any person. And I'll just use the word you referring to anybody. Say you have a strong feeling that it's an insult to leave or hang up on others without saying goodbye. This happened to you when you were getting to know someone you liked very much and hoped to have a deeper relationship with them. It had seemed like they liked and respected you a lot too, but then they left you in an awkward situation without letting you know they were going. Now, many years later, you get angry when even people on TV just hang up without ending a phone call. And if anyone does this to you now, you ghost them. It will almost inevitably remind you of the potential relationship that got away because of this rudeness. And that memory always evokes some sense that you are undesirable. If you bring mindfulness to that feeling and remember this is just a fuzzy memory, you'll have a chance to look at this cause and effect relationship. You might have a moment to consider that departing or hanging up without formally taking your leave is completely acceptable to many people. And then one day you might remember that when you were quite young, someone scolded you severely for doing this and made you feel really bad. You begin to see the origin of this attitude of yours and how it has become increasingly tangled up with dukkha over the years. It's even possible, maybe in a meditation a little while later, to realize that you can just drop this old attitude and be free of that whole source of suffering. How we hold the past determines how well we understand the meaning of our memories. It's a little like dreams. It's just the mind producing false experiences now, ones that leave us unsettled. The more real they seem to us, the closer we're holding them. When we remember that it's just a dream or a memory, we're holding them at enough distance to investigate how they trouble us and why. Now, clearly, it's futile to try to never think about the past, because so many things in the present are related to past events. It is skillful, though, to remember that this means we still have some emotional attachment to these old events, or we wouldn't be thinking of them. For me, this is especially true with memories of loved ones who have died, or favorite places where I've lived or visited. If I don't hold them at some distance, they can make my relationship with current reality a little wobbly. Now, as I said before, the future is pretty straightforward about desire and aversion. It's a big blank screen that we can project almost anything onto. And we do a lot, almost all the time. From the best case scenario to the worst, we go through it all. The least skillful thing that we can do is to keep replaying scenarios of what we hope or dread might happen in the future. For several years when I was young, like about 10 years old, my dad's job was to make plans for whatever might happen. That sounds interesting, and it really was, since he was a senior army officer stationed in Germany during the Cuban Missile Crisis. So while we were ducking covering under our school desks, he was in the office calculating how many battalions should be sent where and what the casualties might be. At night, while he packed to go away on war games, we kids would serenade him with the song, "Please, Mr. Custer, please don't make me go." We appreciated the humor in that much more than he did. We have to think ahead to consider what the future might be and how we can prepare for that. In our present situation with this disease, fear of the future could apply to how we can cope with the world's economic situation, or to your health or your loved ones. The future is always a bit scary because we simply can't know what will happen. We should give it our attention long enough to prepare for what appears possible, and then stop thinking about it. My wife often accuses me of catastrophizing. She did that more than once in late January and early February, as the news reported China's response to this deadly flu. And I stocked up on non-perishable food and essential supplies. Preparing for something doesn't mean it's going to happen. All my father's plans for disaster were happily archived, unused, to the whole world's great relief. And for the foreseeable future now, Carl and I will still keep canned food in the cupboard just in case. My mom liked to say, "Prepare for the worst and be glad for better things." In thinking about the worst that could happen, there's usually fear. There certainly was in the 60s when nuclear war seemed imminent. Whether we can prepare sensibly often depends on how we hold the likelihood of something we don't want to happen. We need a little of the distance that my father had that let him prepare for a nuclear holocaust. as just part of his job. We need a little of the distance and all the dread we can muster won't keep an event from happening. So if we just keep our minds open, keep a little space between our thoughts and the edges of our awareness, we have this opportunity to learn so much and to respond appropriately. Planning and preparing can serve a therapeutic function also, maybe letting us make peace with certain possibilities by knowing that we've done what we can. What we want to be aware of is compulsive planning. When the mind has repeated the same plan more than 3 times, it's just making you crazier. Think through your options realistically, and then put the plan aside with the hope that you don't have to use it. Just getting this much sunlight between our thoughts and emotional reactions to them will hold us in good stead. Even if we can't remember the plan when something does happen, we'll at least be a little more clear-headed in thinking our way through the actual real-time experience. So much for the dread of the future. It can also be alluring or comforting. And now that I've prepared for the worst that I think can happen with this pandemic, I generally think that we're in for a rocky year or so, but then things will be okay. I do project to a future when we can all get together again for a potluck or go out dancing. And I can go camping or fly to visit my family or someplace exotic. As comforting as positive future thoughts may be, they have a catch to them. They set us up for disappointment. As you may know, my ankle got broken, and for the 7 weeks that I was in a cast, I fantasized about getting it off. Now, the past few days without the cast haven't been what I had hoped for. My ankle is still sore and weak. I'm hardly tripping the light fantastic, but I can walk fairly normally and go about my business much more freely. So it's important to hold our hopes for the future with the same distance as we should, I hate to use that word, hold our fears. And remember, they're just thoughts with a lot of clinging, and therefore dukkha. Like most Dharma talks, I started this one with the thought that it would be simple and short. Oh well, with each paragraph I prepared, I saw more possibilities unfold for investigating the way the mind works. I've shared a bit about my own mental processes, and you all have your mental habits. I just hope that you'll take home one particular principle. If we hold the past and future at arm's length, but still within our grasp, then we can explore the mental pathways that lead to both suffering and joy. And with wise effort, we can direct our thoughts in ways that will decrease the suffering and magnify the joy. Thank you.